Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM, Seattle. The best in true crime, conspiracy, and history with Al Warren and Kev Thompson.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM. I'm Al Warren.
And this is Kev Thompson.
So, here we go. Another day. Got your coffee?
Good Lord, I don't need coffee today. With our guest today, I don't need coffee.
Yeah, you're all hyped. Hyped and ready. So, of course, we talk about shows, and we've reviewed a lot of shows, and one of my favorite was the Mindhunters on Netflix. And we're lucky enough to have one of them join us. So we're going to jump right into it. We've got author Mark Ulshaker. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Wow. And we were talking about this before. You have written an incredible amount of great books. And not just Mindhunters, but like I said, we're going through the cases that haunt us. And first of all, how did you get into writing?
Well, I guess I got into writing in high school. I wanted to do something creative, and I was interested in theater and acting, and I wasn't a terribly proficient actor, but I seemed to write pretty well. And I guess it's just something I've always wanted to do, and I think the basics of it is, and you know, I know, Alan, you're a writer as well, is just basic curiosity about the world and what's going on, and this career has allowed me to live other people's lives vicariously, both professionals and the people I write about, and so it's been very interesting. And the books I've done with John Douglas, the FBI's behavioral profiling pioneer, and now I think we've just done number eight, they allow me to live his life vicariously as well. and all of his thousands of cases.
Yeah, that could be pretty interesting. That must be at times it must just blow you away, some of the cases.
Yeah, and you know, as writers, we always say we're both as fiction writers and nonfiction writers, and I've published both, that we're looking for great characters. One just stumbled into my life. The way it started was, I also do documentary film work, or have in the past, mostly for PBS, and I had written and co-produced a number of programs for PBS's science series, Nova, and this goes back to around the time that The Silence of the Lambs was being produced as a movie, and I'd read the book, and I said to the executive producer at Nova up in Boston, look, I read the book, and I really liked it, and I think this is going to be a big movie, at least if it's anywhere like the book. And I didn't know how big a movie it would be, of course. And I said, why don't you let me look into the story of the real behavioral scientists and profilers at the FBI that this is based on? And so at that point, not that many other people knew about them or were interested. And so the FBI kind of welcomed me and my production partner, Larry Klein, with open arms. And we hung around and observed, and then we did a film which was nominated for an Emmy called Mind of a Serial Killer, which not only did well in the ratings, but every time PBS showed it, the investigative support unit of the FBI got a rash of new requests, which so they kind of looked at us with it was a double-edged sword because they liked the publicity, but we're overworked as it was. And then when the unit chief, John Douglas, the one who really developed the profiling program for the FBI, when he got ready to retire, he called me and said, "Do you think anybody would be interested in my story?" And I said, "Well, I'm certainly interested, but let's go to New York and see." And so we shopped a proposal around to various publishers, and we got overwhelming reaction. The book Mindhunter became a big bestseller, allowed us to keep writing other books on the subjects of criminal investigative analysis and behavioral profiling. Going up through our last one, the last published one, Law and Disorder, which is really about using behavioral science to not just to catch the bad guys, but to exonerate people who have been erroneously charged and convicted of crimes. And then finally, after many years in development, Mindhunter became a dramatic series on Netflix, directed by David Fincher, and we couldn't be more pleased.
Yeah. And I was saying that earlier before we got on. That turned out so well. I mean, they did a really good job of that series.
I agree.
You know, they really they got the right actors too to create those characters, like to have just the way they grew throughout the season was, I thought it was great, really good.
I did too, and you know, I didn't know the actors ahead of time. I'm not that into popular culture, and we knew ahead of time from David Fincher that he planned on fictionalizing some of the characters' traits and details, which we were fine with, keeping the bad guys as themselves with their own names, which we also were fine with. But as I was telling you before we went on, Al, it's very true to the book in all the important ways. It's very respectful of the book. It doesn't oversell. It's not like Criminal Minds where the profilers go in with guns blazing and all of that. They don't do that kind of thing. They're
human.
They work with the police, and they're human. And I think not having a lot of overt violence, but showing the effects of violence and the psychological tolls, make it a very interesting show.
Oh, yeah.
And we're thrilled that it's been renewed for a second season already.
Well, now we have to wait.
Yes. We all do.
Thanks. So, Mark, this is Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. Yeah.
Now, when you say that you had all the characters already, you know, in your mind, Edward Kemper,
yeah.
How accurate is that?
It's a very accurate representation. I think probably he's a little more avuncular on screen than in real life, but I think it's a very accurate representation. He looks a lot like him, and the motivation that is described is very good. I think it brings up, which I know, Kevin, you would get into with me if I didn't bring it up on my own, which is the whole idea which we get asked constantly, which is, are serial predators born or made? And I think Ed Kemper is a good example of our answer that both. This is somebody who probably had a certain amount of hard wiring into predatory and antisocial ideas, but the way he was brought up, the way he was raised, and the way he ultimately wanted to get back to his mother, at his mother, which he did, are very accurate and very true to life.
Because a lot of the questions that we get is, did the interviews go like they did on television?
To a large extent, they did. The one thing, of course, is that the interviews extended for many hours. You don't get somebody to open up to you right away. There's a lot of talk that goes into it first. And the other thing that the show didn't demonstrate, but it is true nonetheless. Before the interviewers, the would-be profilers, went in to talk to each prisoner, they would go through the case file extensively, the police case file, or if the FBI had the case file, and then they would go into the prisons and study the prisoner's prison file before going in. So they really needed to know everything they could about the person and the individual and the crime and the victim before they talked to each of these incarcerated convicts. So that's the sort of added part of it. And the only other things are minor. They didn't actually tape the conversations because John was very concerned that they would be perceived to be reporting the information back to other people. And, you know, convicts tend to be very paranoid, as you might expect. So what they would do instead, rather than tape, they would ask questions, and then as soon as they would get out of the interview hours later, they had a questionnaire and a profiling form that they would fill out in great detail from memory.
You know, and that's portrayed in the show as well. For example, whenever they do break out the tape recorder, and I believe it's in episode 2 with Edward Kemper, he gets a little, you know, he gets a little hesitant and then gets a little bit cocky.
Yeah, and now, I think we all would.
Yeah. Now, how much of that cockiness do you think is him self-grandiose, you know, being self-grandiose?
Well, remember, they're all going to have a grandiose streak to begin with, which brings up another interesting point, that most of these serial predators, there are two elements warring within them. One is this grandiosity, the sense of entitlement, this sense that life hasn't treated them well, that they should have a better job, a better status in life, whatever, and that they're just entitled to go take it. And warring with that is this deep-seated feeling of inadequacy that most of them have. And so they're fighting within themselves constantly. So I think if you saw a touch of grandiosity and cockiness in Ed Kemper or any of the others, that's pretty accurate. In fact, at one point, Kemper said to John's partner, Bob Ressler, you know, I'm in here for life. I'm never getting out. If I was to, and he's a big guy, as you know, and he said, if I were to just grab your head and twist it off your shoulders and put it on the table in front of us, what are they going to do to me? Take away my ice cream?
Yeah.
Right.
I would say there's a certain amount of cockiness there, yes.
Yeah, and I understand that. I work in corrections, and what are you going to give to a man that already has life?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, one thing that kind of it shows during the series and that and in the book, a lot of the police at the time in the 60s and FBI wasn't really on board with this whole profiling, were they?
No, and probably as long as J. Edgar Hoover remained alive, it was going to be a just-the-facts-man type organization. They were all evidence had to be completely objective. Anything that sort of smacked of psychology or soft sciences or touchy-feely stuff, Hoover and his lieutenants really didn't care for. So it really was a learning process, and the idea that we've got to prove this to the brass that this works. And it, as you saw from the series and from the book Mindhunter, it took years.
I would imagine. What do you think is so fascinating that the whole public now and everybody's so interested in serial killers?
Well, I think it's like any other boogeyman, like werewolves or witches or vampires or whatever. I mean, it gives us a chance to live on the edge vicariously. But I think there's also something more profound about our interest in true crime and why it stays, and it's an evergreen genre, if you will. There will always be detective shows on television and always have been. And I think that's because true crime really deals with what we can conveniently call the human condition. It's about all the things that we feel as human beings: love, hate, revenge, jealousy, desire, envy, whatever, except it's writ large. It's lived at the extremes. All the things that we can normally suppress or repress in ourselves, in crime, it comes out into the open without any filters. And so I really think it's about us wanting to know more about the range of human experience and the range of human emotions and what happens when they're unchecked, because what makes society work is having people restrain themselves. And the people who don't restrain themselves become aberrations, and they're very fascinating aberrations. Fortunately, none of them are as fascinating in real life as Hannibal Lecter or anything like that. People who are that brilliant and that successful generally find other things to do other than go into crime.
Yeah. You know, and that's not the typical, right?
Serial
killers are not. It doesn't mean that they're automatically super intelligent or...
No, and most of them aren't. Most of them are average, I would say. What makes them successful, though, is that they've gotten away with it a number of times. And any person, any of us are going to learn from our successes as well as our failures. So a serial killer, by definition, is a successful killer.
And we were talking about that. And this brings in with serial killers, like the cases that haunt us, one of your other books. Mm-hmm. So you bring out some of the best points. And I have to say to the listeners, because we do a ton of shows on Jack the Ripper and Joan Binet and all these cases that really stick with us. And I was saying this before, how just going through your premise in the book, just when reading it, just with the evidence that you give, just laying it out simple and factual, takes away 90% of the theories that we get on this show.
Well, that's good to hear.
And I mean that seriously, because what's happened so much in the world is we see people that have this idea, this person, this is the person that did it. And then they build their case around that. And they miss out so much of the evidence. They're not just laying out, like you express how it was in the 1880s in London, in Whitechapel, what was going on, how much prostitution there was. And you kind of go through the outlay. You paint the picture and then describe the crimes. And so many people are doing it backwards nowadays.
Well, I think that's true. You guys both know from your experience, if you start out with what we call a confirmation bias, whether you're the police, whether you're the public, whether you're a detective, a profiler, whatever, it's very easy to achieve the results you seek or to get the evidence you want and have it prove what you want it to. But that doesn't mean it's going to be right. Every case has holes in it, and so you have to look at the preponderance of the evidence, you have to look at the big picture, and you have to be open and objective to what you're seeing. In our last published book, Law and Disorder, we focused on a number of cases, the JonBenet Ramsey case, as you suggested, the West Memphis 3 murder case in Arkansas, the case involving Amanda Knox and Rafael Solletito in Perugia, Italy. And in each of these cases, the confirmation bias going in destroyed any possibility of a good outcome right from the beginning.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, well, this is Kevin. But let's look at the other side of that. I mean, without a suspect or a focal point, how do you narrow? How do you narrow it down? Like, okay, for example,
Very good question.
Yeah, you've got to start somewhere. You've got the victims, you've got these clues, but you've also, in Whitechapel, you've got, just for the sake of a number, 10,000 suspects. How do you narrow that down?
Well, it's all very good. Now, if we're talking about modern techniques and profiling, well, first of all, you let the evidence lead you, and that's going to and then let's make this point flat out. Profiling itself, or behavioral science, isn't going to get you to the finish line. The main thing is still good detective work. It's following up leads. It's interviewing witnesses, if there are any. It's talking to people who in the area. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to marry the good detective work with good evidence, physical evidence, chemical evidence, behavioral evidence, and then try to figure out who you're talking about. And what behavioral profiling does, Kevin, is help you with that very point you're talking about, which is to narrow the field. It won't give you any names, most likely, but it'll help you narrow the field down to the type of person you're looking for. And then, based on what you know about that type of person's likely behavior, you can start talking about proactive techniques to try to find that person, to get him or her to come forward, almost always a him, and which we can talk about if you like, and so that you can actually get closer to finding that person rather than just waiting for another murder to happen and hopefully get better evidence.
Hence Mindhunters, because we know the what, we know the when, we know the how, but it's the why that leads us to who.
You're exactly right. John Douglas always says, he uses the equation, why plus how equals who.
There you go. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, it is that easy, but we're making it sound...
Well, it's not that easy, but it's
no,
that,
not at
that
all.
Straightforward, yes.
Yeah. So now these cases, like we talk about this, why do they stick with us, particular cases? Like you can look at John Wayne Gacy. And Son of Sam and certain ones like that, they really stick with us year after year after year. Look at Zodiac,
yeah.
You know, the new
again, a good question. What we tried to do with the cases that haunt us was take murder cases going fairly far back, in this case to Jack the Ripper in London in 1888, and going up through the JonBenet Ramsey case in the 1990s in Boulder, Colorado, and say these are cases which either haven't been solved or the solution does not seem satisfying to people. And yet, why do certain cases stick with us? It's because they represent something. There's something of an archetype there. They represent something that we can all relate to from our own experience, from the stories we read, from American or world tradition. So there's something about each of these cases that just resonates with us. In the case of Jack the Ripper, it's sort of the ultimate unknown ghost in the night. With JonBenet Ramsey, it's the, you know, all-American little princess, totally innocent, who just all of a sudden is killed in her own home. With the Lindbergh kidnapping case, it's perhaps even more basic than that. You have to remember that in 1932, when this kidnapping took place, Charles Lindbergh was the most famous human being in the world. And every mother of the time was saying to herself and to her husband and to those around her, if Charles Lindbergh's baby can be kidnapped and killed, how are the rest of us safe?
That's true.
So it's usually something that penetrates deep into our psyche and speaks directly to our most primal fears.
Do you think that that's possibly why there's such a fascination with these type of shows? You know, for example, Mindhunters, you know, you've got Criminal Minds, you know, you've got all these crime shows, because I want to appreciate my safety. I want to appreciate my space by seeing how bad it can possibly be out there. And I am a comfortable distance away from it. But
I think that's certainly a critical element. And then I think the other critical element is we are attuned as human beings to problem solving and solving mysteries. And each of these presents a profound mystery. And most of us like puzzles, or the younger generation, way younger than me, and I think younger than you two guys, like video games and things like that. So we're always looking for that, you know, kind of a challenge to unwrap, and mysteries are a big challenge.
Yeah.
Until Google.
Yeah.
Well, that's just, we're not going to go there. Now, so you brought up Amanda Knox, and of course, being in Seattle, I've talked to her. Now, how do you think cases like that, when they get brought into the media, you know, Nancy Grace and all this stuff, and it's, how can you have a, depend on a trial, is what I'm trying to say. How can they really get a fair trial?
It's very challenging. And I think the problem with that particular case, and unlike the Ramsey case, which is very complicated, the murder of Meredith Kircher in Perugia, Italy, that was not a difficult case to solve. It was very straightforward. I mean, we know who did it. We know why he did it. We know how he did it. And the fact that the police couldn't see that is almost incomprehensible to me. But what I said directly to Amanda, sitting across a dining table from her, is the reason you were convicted, in my opinion, is because the story that the police and then the media put out was much better than what actually happened. And when you get and narrative in our lives, storytelling is extremely primal. And when you get a story that's better than the truth and evidence, as you guys well know, often doesn't have much of a chance.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that seems to be. I just don't know how. Like writing, I wrote two books for Crimes in Canada. And now they do things differently, and they're not allowed to broadcast on the media until the case has already been tried and done. Do you think that's a possibility in the U.S.?
Well, you know, that's again a double-edged sword. Yes, we would certainly like to keep media bias and public bias out of the case. On the other hand, there are many situations, and John Douglas has promoted this throughout his career, where the public is actually your best partner in solving a case. If you can say, we're looking for this kind of person, we think he might have had this kind of behavior afterwards, he may have started drinking, he may have started taking drugs, he may have lost weight, he may seem nervous, he may be cutting out articles or following the media very closely, talking about it, he may have missed work, he may have left town, whatever the individual details that you think are accurate are, very often the public can come forward and tell you. In fact, I can think of one case, I believe it was in Seattle, where the FBI did publish characteristics of a serial arsonist, and it was his father who turned him in.
Right. Yeah, and but, just like the Unabomber too, right?
That's a perfect example. I mean, I was, I was closely following and involved with the FBI at that point, and I can tell you there were agonizing meetings both within the FBI and between the FBI and the Washington Post and the New York Times as to whether they should publish what the Unabomber called the manifesto, and and the newspapers were rightly very concerned about giving in to his demands because they thought, well, they can then be held hostage by any nut who wants to get his ideas published. But the FBI ended up really encouraging them to publish it because they said, this is a long document. Somebody could very easily recognize something in it and come forward, and that's exactly what happened. Ted Kaczynski's sister-in-law, his brother David's wife, said, God, this sounds an awful lot like Ted. And that's what happened.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. And I just realized...
So again, that is a double-edged sword about media involvement. And so there's no straight answer, but I think on the whole, I'd probably rather have our system where we're free to talk about it.
But, Mark, I think what Al was asking, though, okay, we're talking the difference between America's Most Wanted and Court TV.
Yeah.
You know, America's Most Wanted said we're looking for this type of person. Mm-hmm. And like you were talking about, you know, if you put the public on alert, we're looking for this type of person. They're going to look this way, act this way. But what if we already have a suspect? For example, and I am guilty of this, and I admit it on the air. Court TV, I think, was birthed on Michael Jackson. We had a suspect. You know, we had a suspect, and they publicized the entire trial. And I remember standing in my bedroom on that final day when they were getting ready to bring the verdict. And
you're talking about Michael Jackson or O.J. Simpson?
Oh, Michael Jackson.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that as well, but certainly I remember the O.J. Simpson trial,
yeah.
Which I think it was then called – I can't remember what it was called. Was it called Court TV in those days? I guess it was.
Yes, Court TV. Court TV was birthed on Michael Jackson. And I was convinced that he was guilty. Why? Because of all of this publicity watching the trial. Mm-hmm. And I was astounded when they came back with a not guilty verdict. And I think that's kind of what Al was alluding to, is the fact that all of this publicity will absolutely bias an entire country or a viewing audience against one particular person.
Well, I think you're right. It can happen, and it certainly happened in the case of John and Patsy Ramsey. Before anything, I mean, within a week, the entire country was absolutely convinced they'd murdered their daughter.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, yeah. I see. You also wrote the Unabomber book, didn't you? I didn't.
Yeah. We that was a lot of pressure because Simon & Schuster came to us immediately after Ted Kaczynski was identified and said, remember, this was in the 90s, so this was pre-widespread use of the Internet, so things were a little different in publishing those days. And they said, why don't you guys do an instant book? And I said, well, what does an instant book mean? They said, like, right away. So we literally wrote that book in 6 days. I would like to say on the seventh day we rested, but we probably did. So that was an interesting experience. But, you know, I've had occasion to look at the book not too long ago, and it holds up pretty well, amazingly well, actually, in terms of what it says. And then I've had occasion to meet with David Kaczynski since then, and he's confirmed a lot of what we speculated about.
Yeah, it feels good then, hey?
It absolutely does.
Now, because it's only an hour show, I wanted to cover some of the other things you've done.
Sure.
And I've noticed one of the things that you were kind of writing about seemed to be kind of a specialty of yours was the thing about the deadly enemies, about
killer drones. My latest book is came out last spring from Little Brown, called Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs, with Dr. Michael Osterholm, who's a very prominent epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And I know your follow-up question is going to be, so what do germs have to do with serial killers? Well, the answer is they can both be killers, and my interest in public health along with criminal justice probably stems from a lot of the same source, which is these are both criminal justice and public health are detective stories, different kinds of detectives, but detectives nonetheless, and they're hunting down potential killers. And the mysteries in both cases, the high technological and human drama in both cases, I think are very palpable. And so I've been interested in both subjects for a long time, and sometimes they overlap, as you might imagine in the case of bioterror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, countries have used, we even hear that today with Syria and different countries about
killing
people, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that subject? Like, how do you like things like Ebola and, you know, Zika and all these viruses that are around now? Do you feel it's something we need to be concerned about?
Absolutely. I mean, when we were promoting the book, one of the things we really focused on was it was just about the time that President Trump was setting forth his first draft of a new budget, which would up the military's budget by about 15% and cut a lot of other things to make up for it, including National Institutes of Health and things like that. And we made the point that if you are trying to protect national security and you're just focusing on human killers like armies and bombs and things like that, you're missing a major point of national security, which is our protection from diseases, particularly infectious diseases. We started the book during the Ebola crisis. We finished the book during the Zika crisis, and there's no reason to think that we're not going to have continual crises after that. And particularly, we all know from history about the 1918 influenza virus, the so-called Spanish flu, that went 2.5 times around the world and killed between 50 and 100 million people. Now, we may think that we're in better shape to take care of that, something like that would happen again like that with 100 years of science under our belts. But in fact, we're less able to take care of something like that now. We have 3 times the population. We have airplane travel, which means anybody who's infected can get to anywhere else in the world within a matter of hours. We've got tremendous amount of international travel. We have we are losing our wilderness areas where these viruses can hide, so they're spread to the public a lot quicker. We've got huge populations now in mega slums in places like Kinshasa and Lagos in Africa and different places in Southeast Asia and elsewhere. And we've also got a world-connected just-in-time delivery system so that if one part of the world is affected, it affects all other parts of the world. Let's just give you a real quick example. Dr. Osterholm and his group about 5 years ago did a survey where they asked doctors of pharmacology at some of the leading hospitals in the country, what were the drugs that you needed to just to save lives on a daily basis? We're not even talking about the heart drugs, cholesterol-lowering drugs or cancer drugs. We're talking about the stuff that's like on the crash cart in the emergency room. And they came up with about 30 drugs, including insulin and things like that. What was interesting is all 30 of those drugs were generic. They were out of patent, so they were all generic drugs. And all of them were primarily manufactured outside the United States. And the best hospital in the country had no more than a 30-day supply. So if there's a worldwide pandemic of anything, we may have the best hospitals in the world. It's not going to matter if we can't get the life-saving drugs to cure people. So that's just one example of how unprepared we are.
And here's how easy it can happen. Wasn't there a case here in the last few years where there was a cult that was actually contaminated a salad bar with bacterial agents?
Yes, the Sri Rajneesh cult just below you guys in Oregon, I believe it was. And their plan was simple. We'll poison salad bars right before an election so that we can take over the town by voting.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, we all know about Oregon. So
there's another case where crime and germs come together.
I find that really fascinating. I'm really interested in that subject, and I just wonder why it doesn't get talked about more.
I think people are even more afraid of the subject than they are of crime. I think most people feel, well, we can probably stay away from crime, or it's not likely to hit me. But we all get viruses, we all get bacterial infections, and I think it's a little too terrifying for most people, and including a lot of people in the government.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And I'll speak from experience, because that's exactly how I feel. I can point at a killer. You know, I mean, I work in the business. You know, I can walk up and down the rows and point to killers, but a virus, you can't see it, you can't fight it, you can't stop it.
And if you have a virus like influenza, and it happens to be a very virulent and deadly strain, you can catch it just by breathing. I mean, think about it. What if the only difference from AIDS to the way it really is was, instead of getting it through extreme bodily fluid contact and transfer, what if you could get it through breathing? We'd all be dead by now.
You know, and here's another scary thought, since we're on this. You know, if a person jumps up in an airplane with a gun, you may be able to stop them, but if they just simply spray something, that whole plane is dead.
That's right. And the scary thing is, if it's a virus, if it's a deadly virus, something on the order of smallpox, for instance, we won't even know for days afterwards that a crime has been committed.
Oh, great. Thanks, Mark.
No, it's a real
problem. Even something like anthrax, which we know what it is, we know how to cure it. But if a large volume of anthrax spores were released, say, in the Mall of America, I think there would be no way you could clean a place like that up. It would be like the Chernobyl of the plains. You'd have this rotting hulk there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and you wouldn't be able to get close to it. You couldn't clean up something that big from anthrax spores.
And as fast as it would spread, because, okay, let's say we do a tactical nuke. You know that it's only going to spread so far.
Exactly.
If I start shooting people, the range of the weapon is only so far.
Right.
But if I contaminate an area with viruses or bacteria,
right?
Okay, you may be able to contain that area, but who has come and gone since the containment?
Where
did they go?
Mm-hmm. Just as an example, and this was not a crime, obviously, but look at the measles outbreak that had its center at Disneyland a couple of years ago. I think that ended up contaminating like 35 states or something before they were done. And unfortunately, we don't take measles seriously anymore, and so the herd immunity to measles was not what it should be.
Wow. Now, you actually wrote Man Down as well, right? Or you're part of that?
I'm part of that series. I actually created the characters. That was part of a series we began called Broken Wings, which was actually based on – that's a novel that was based on an actual idea that John had, which was to create kind of a crime-solving flying squad that had all the facilities, both behaviorists and lab people and crime scene technicians that could go anywhere in the country on a moment's notice and try to solve a crime before it got too old. In other words, in the first 48 hours, if possible.
So it's kind of focused more on terrorist attack?
Not necessarily. It could be any kind of crime, but certainly it would have an implication for terrorist attacks, yeah.
Wow, all the happy thoughts.
Yes. What else can I brighten your nice days with?
Well, you know, makes you feel good, hey? So, who was Jack the Ripper?
Well, I'm worrying with myself right now about whether I should give it away or make your listeners buy the book, but let me say that what we did was we applied, we looked at all of the physical evidence that was available. We went to the crime scenes, we drew lines around where the concentric circles around where the crimes took place. We looked at the order of the crimes, we looked at the evolution and acceleration of the crimes. And then we talked to people at Scotland Yard and looked at all the written material. And we concluded that much as we would have liked one of the sexy suspects like Queen Victoria's grandson, Prince Edward, or the royal physician, or any of those, we concluded that it had to be a denizen of the East End. And as you said earlier, you have to understand what the East End was in those days. And we're pretty convinced that we identified the suspect, and the reason is because if you triangulate reports from Scotland Yard, it's very much my opinion, and I think a lot of the current detectives at the Yard who studied the case agree with me, that even though nobody was brought to trial, the police actually knew who did it. And the most compelling evidence for that is that the East End was swarming with cops, both from the Metropolitan Police Force and the City Police Force, which was police force for the financial district where a lot of this stuff happened. And they were being roundly criticized by the newspapers for not having caught the unknown subject and all of that. And then right almost immediately after the last murder, that of Mary Kelly, which was a total dismemberment murder, right after that the police stood down and they took all the cops away. Now, you cannot convince me that that would have happened if they hadn't thought that the threat was over.
Yeah, yeah. It's
so is that a way of teasing the audience about who did it without actually telling them?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. I mean, I'm listening, so I know. But they,
yeah.
That's good. Make them go out and buy. That's what they need. No, it's
the cases that haunt us, by John Douglas and Mark Olshaker.
That's right. You know, there's fascinating. We actually will have all of your books placed on our website because.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
I'm telling you, it's just it's like finding a treasure. Great books. Great, great books. Well, what's next for you? Are you planning the Mindhunters 2?
Well, we are planning another one. Taking off on the success of the Mindhunter television series, what people have been asking us for a long time is, well, you've sort of touched on it in your books, but could you give us an in-depth look at how these interviews actually take place? What transpires between a guy like John Douglas and a violent offender when he's interviewed in prison? And how do you actually learn enough, get enough insight to correlate what was going on in the predator's mind with the evidence that you see at the crime scene? So we're actually doing a book now in which we are looking at a couple of cases, some cases that people know well, some cases that they don't know well, and showing an in-depth dialogue and insight, if you will, between John and incarcerated criminals. So that's our next book, I think.
Well, keep them coming. We're thrilled.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're thrilled. Well, that's great. We've really enjoyed this time.
As have I.
I hope you'll come back anytime.
Anytime you invite me.
You know, we love talking about crime. That's sort of what we do. And now everything will be on the website. Now, you have a website as well. What would that be?
We do, but I'm not going to give it to you right now because we're trying to clean it up and do more. We've been pretty busy, so we haven't been able to do much lately. But we'll let you know, and we'll be revivifying it pretty soon.
Okay.
Another teaser.
Yeah.
But all of our books are available on Amazon in all different kinds of forms. Mindhunter has just been released in a new version to coincide with the television series, so it's got a new introduction that we wrote to bring readers up to date on what's happened since, who's still alive, who's died, which cases have been solved, which haven't. So we think readers will be interested in that.
Yeah, and again, we'll have everything posted on our website, and whenever yours is back up and running, we'll have that posted as well. So
great.
So it's been a great show. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Alan. You know where to reach me.
Of course. So again, our host has been Mark Olshaker, and of course, he's the one of the Mindhunters that you see on the Netflix series. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you guys both.
Mark, it's been an honor. Thank you.
Okay, welcome back. And now we're on to the conspiracy countdown of the week. And joining us is Joe Usinski, our professor in Miami. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Great to be with you this week. Thanks for having me.
Always. So, what have you found out?
In trolling through the internet this week, I have our top three conspiracy theories that are making their way around. Before I start with the top three, I want to give you our number four runner-up, and that is that Amelia Earhart, some people say that she just crashed out in the ocean and we haven't been able to fully find out what happened to her, but some people are saying this week that she was eaten by giant coconut crabs. Now, this isn't really a conspiracy theory on its own, unless the coconut crabs were somehow conspiring to eat her and hide their activities as such. But it's being called and treated a conspiracy theory, perhaps because this this knowledge might have been hidden from us. But if you see the pictures of the crabs online, you might see this as plausible because the crabs are known to eat things as large as cats, and they're fairly large, large coconut crabs. So that's our runner-up for the week.
Now, is that somewhere near Russia? Are they Russian coconut crabs?
No, this is out in the Pacific, and they have a few islands where they say this may have happened. But they say she crashed, made it to an island, and either she was eaten alive by the crabs or her corpse was disposed of by these giant crabs.
Oh, well, that's good. Now we can have a crab killer, just like the pig farmer. there'll be a new one. We're giving someone the idea. There we go.
So I guess if you're ever accused of murder, just say the crabs did it, and then that's your get out of jail card.
Yeah, the crabs did it, just like Amelia. That's how I learned it.
All right, so for our number three, and I'm not sure this gets that much more sane, but our third most popular conspiracy theory making its rounds this week is that planet Nibiru is on a collision course with Earth and may spell doom for us in the coming months. And this has also been tied in with reports that Jupiter and Venus are going to smash in together. And if that were to happen, that would cause 14 days of darkness, they're saying. What scientists say is that if you have 8 days of darkness, that would be really bad for the planet and probably be extinction level. But with two planets in our solar system smashing, or with another planet just coming to smash into us, that would be extinction-level events. So that's our number three for the week.
Jeez, we have 8 days of darkness in Seattle all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen what happens with 30 days of night.
Is that why the vampires come out in Alaska?
Yes, all the vampires come out.
Oh, great.
And going back to the crabs, I mean, I'm still here, and I had crabs once.
I think that's a very different kind of crab, and the size of the crab might be exponentially different.
She just didn't have the same comb that I had.
Yeah. Well, she was stranded on an island.
Well, look what Gilligan was able to do on an island.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, number two.
So, number two, Roy Moore, Senator, well, George, the judge, and then Senate candidate Roy Moore in Alabama, is accused of inappropriate relations of varying degrees with young women dating back decades. And the conspiracy theories surrounding this are one, are these allegations made up as some sort of plot to bring him down? And then two, there's this question of robocalls that have been made in Alabama.
Uh-oh.
Where there's a message that's being sent to people on their telephones that says something along the lines of, "Hi, my name is Bernie Bernstein from the Washington Post. If you're a woman and you have a story to tell about Judge Roy Moore, I'm happy to print it, and I won't even verify if it's true."
Oh,
so the conspiracy theory is about this, is that they are trying to, this is either somebody from the judge's campaign trying to sow the seeds of doubt about the accusations against the judge and make it look as if there's a conspiracy by the Washington Post and perhaps Jewish people to get the judge. Or, and this might be equally plausible, that somebody is planting these robocalls to make it look as if the campaign is trying to make it look as if there was a conspiracy. So we may be going down a rabbit hole with some of this stuff. But the number two of the week is the robocalls around Judge Roy Moore.
Wow. You know, it's probably Kevin.
you know, I'm off during the day. I got nothing but time to sit here and randomly call numbers in Alabama.
Yeah.
And I am a Jew.
There we go. We knew it. The Jews did
it. So here in Seattle, if you have a story about Roy Moore, please call me and I won't even verify it. We'll say that on air.
Now, what they've said about these robocalls is they sound incredibly fake from the reports, to not be really convincing in any way.
Well, we're not.
If you do go back in time, there have been accusations, particularly during tight campaigns, where, you know, if you go back to, I think it was South or North Carolina back in 2000 in the primary race between Bush and McCain, they say that there were some push polls put out there that insinuated that McCain might have had an interracial baby that he was hiding, and that this may have tipped the scales in favor of George W. Bush. So these calls are sometimes used to, you know, sway public opinion one way or another, oftentimes with very dirty tactics because no one's recording the telephone and no one can really track down who's making these calls.
Yeah.
So who's reporting this?
So these phone calls are getting widely reported, so by quite a few different sources. So there's quite a few people who've received the calls, and they're all the same. So the transcript has been made available by people who've written it down, which has led to a joke on Twitter. And because this fictitious reporter's name is Bernie Bernstein, they said, you know, if you want to be part of the Jewish conspiracy, then just pick it's your first name. And then your first name again with Steen at the end. And that is your Alabama Jewish conspiracy name.
Well, there
Alan Warrenstein.
Warrenstein.
Yes.
You can be Warren Warrenstein.
Yes.
Perfect.
Thompson-stein. And, I was groped by Roy Moore in a broom closet.
And was it good?
Well, I mean, it was full cut. You know, it was comfortable. It was warm.
Well, onward. So what's the big one of the week?
So the number one conspiracy theory this week is the Hillary Clinton Uranium One scandal, which has been simmering for some months. But it's made a big splash this week. For two reasons. One is that Representative Louie Gohmert put out a flowchart showing all the different actors involved in the conspiracy to give preferential treatment in this particular matter, and trying to allege a whole host of nefarious characters in this uranium deal. And after that chart sort of confused people because they had essentially hundreds of connections drawn between many different actors, Sean Hannity put out a more simplified version that made some of the connections a little bit more clear, but it was essentially getting to the same idea, and that is that Hillary Clinton was involved in some shady dealings on this particular deal, and this is sort of a big conspiracy theory this week, partially because some people believe it, and partially because other people are shocked at the brazenness at which these accusations are being made, particularly by members of Congress who don't normally traffic in conspiracy theory flowcharts.
Wow. I didn't even think that mattered. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about it.
So a neat thing is that these flowcharts, because of this, have made sort of a comeback. And I don't want to say that only the Republicans are doing it. There's been one put out by the DCCC, which is the Democratic Congressional Committee, and they have put out one that involves a representative from California named Dana Rohrabacher, and it's called the RohrabacherConspiracy.com, and you can look it up. And this is from, you know, the Democrats. And it's got essentially a flow chart, a fairly simple one, but it's got Putin tied in with some Republicans trying to insinuate some sort of Russian control over the Republican Party. But, you know, the Democrats are doing it and the Republicans are doing it too. So I guess we're stuck with these flow charts for at least a little while now.
The new trend. Hillary did it. Oh, well, that's interesting. That's great.
But the crabs have not been accused of being involved in the Uranium One decision in any way. They are left off of that particular flow chart. So that is good.
So. Oh, yeah. Thank God for the crabs. Only ones we can trust.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess that it gets the point across. Just having the conspiracy come out, it brings into doubt everything, right? So,
you know. It does, and it's created a lot of dissension, particularly at Fox News, where you have your nighttime programming saying it's true and putting out these flow charts, and your daytime programming saying it's not true. And so viewers are getting sort of a mixed message if they watch at 3 p.m. or if they watch at 9 p.m. And then you have a lot of a lot of coverage being very negative towards this particular conspiracy theory. Now, one thing I would caution is, you know, there may or may not be something in this Uranium One deal, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't other reasons to be suspicious of the, you know, of the Clinton Foundation or of Hillary Clinton's dealings as Secretary of State. I'm not saying there's anything necessarily there, but it's always good to investigate these sorts of things. And that's something that's been brought up by Attorney General Jeff Sessions this past week as well.
Yeah, now, well, because he needs to do something.
Because at the base of every conspiracy, isn't there a small element of truth? So what would even get this started?
So, well, one thing I would say is that, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories, it's not necessarily about the truth of the theory itself, but we often start out with, well, here's somebody who is very powerful that we don't like, and let's accuse them of doing bad stuff. So there's a psychological element there, and that's why you wind up with people who don't like Hillary Clinton accuse her of conspiring, and people who do like her don't. Now, in terms of how good the evidence is, it's always in the eye of the beholder, because what is good evidence to you in one case might not be good evidence in another case, and what's good evidence to you might not really mean anything to me. So sometimes these things can fly with a little bit of what I would consider good evidence, and sometimes they can fly on almost nothing. I mean, I could tell you there's evidence for the reptilian elite theory, right? I mean,
well, true.
If you say there's interdimensional lizards that rule the planet, I could say, well, our planet exists, and theoretical physics suggests that other dimensions exist, and lizards exist. Well, now we have some kernel of truth. Now, how far does that really get us? Not that far in that instance, but there's something there, obviously, right? But you want to get more and more and more before you settle on the explanation, I think.
Well, so, I'm speechless.
So we got crabs, lizards.
Yes. I mean, it all fits.
Lizards got crabs.
It all. No, they're reptiles. They don't have hair.
But that's a strange thing. They're Jewish reptiles. They have.
No, I know the reptilians exist because they're supposed to be the ruling family. But But then that leads us to England. So that's a whole other conspiracy theory. I think that a reptilian member of the royal family was Jack the Ripper.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, if you go to London and you take the tours, they won't normally say that. They have a whole host of characters that many researchers have pointed out. For a few years, they were saying it was a Polish immigrant, which I found very offensive. And then they did some DNA testing, and they were actually able to rule that one out.
Oh,
so.
Right. Right. I remember that. Yeah, because there was some, wasn't there some semen or something left on the Catherine Eddowes?
They had something that they were able to test, and then they were able to trace it back as best they could.
Yeah.
The blue dress.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thanks very much.
So thank you, and I'll be back with you next week.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.